everybody, and welcome to the Safety Conversation podcast with SHP. My name's Mark Glover. I'm the editor at SHP, and today's episode is going to be a really special one, and hopefully one we have the first in a regular series, which what we're at the moment calling CEO Spotlight. It's an angle we've been looking at for some time, but haven't been completely sure how to approach it. But it's come off the back of a relationship with one of our editorial board members, Nicola White, who has kindly helped instigate this. So in SHP, in our pages, we often talk about a top-down culture and how getting buy-in from management, the board, is sort of so important in integrating that safety culture. And I often hear from professionals who I interview that their CEO is fully supportive in health and safety. It often feels sometimes that's a bit of a well-pedaled line. And, you know, it's very rare, actually, we get to speak to those CEOs as their time's so busy. There's plenty of other responsibilities. And I guess as well, if a CEO does come in, they're probably not going to say that their safety program isn't great. But I'm really pleased to say today we've actually managed to get a chief executive from a really interesting vertical to sort of kick off this series. So joining me today, most importantly, and we'll just check he's there, is Jason Killins, who's the CEO at the Welsh Ambulance Trust. So the Welsh Ambulance Services NHS Trust is the national provider of 999-111 and non-emergency patient transport in Wales, a role Jason's held since 2018. He's got over 20 years of service in this sector and began as an emergency medical technician, EMT. He's worked internationally as the chief exec of the South Australian Ambulance Service, which we'll come on to a bit later, which is really interesting, and previously held various senior leadership roles in London Ambulance Service, including executive director of operations. As I say, most important, let's check if Jason's there. Hi, Jason, how are you?
Hi, Mark. Yeah, I'm good. I'm here. It's good to be with you.
It's really interesting to get you on for a CEO, what health and safety means to you. But if I may remind, if I can rewind even back on your career, when you did begin as an EMT, do you remember what health and safety actually meant to you, what it represented?
Yeah, I mean, well, look, I'll come at it from two angles if I can, Mark. Firstly, sure. You know, what does health and safety mean to me now? I mean, you said in the introduction, you know, chief execs might often talk about their, you know, safety culture and their programs being really good and all that kind of stuff. I mean, for me, this is about protecting our people. Yes, of course, it's important to me personally for the range of, a whole host of reasons that everyone understands, not least, you know, the potential for personal liability here. But actually, it's just about keeping our people safe and well in work. And that's the starting point, clearly. In terms of me and my career, you know, 26th of February 1996 was my first day. My perspective then was different, clearly. You know, I was an operational frontline member of staff working shifts, you know, late nights and weekends in East London, responding to emergencies in our communities. And of course, you know, they are often uncontrolled, highly stressed situations where violence, alcohol, drugs are fueling, you know, various things. So safety, health and safety for frontline emergency service workers, not just those in the ambulance sector, is clearly an important thing for us to consider. But then, you know, as an individual frontline emergency service worker, it was more about me and my crewmate and ensuring that we were safe, be that with the kit, the vehicles, the station, or the environment in which we were in. So it's more focused perhaps on us as individuals, whereas now in this role, you know, I've got a much broader kind of lens, not just about me and the duties I have as an individual, but also the organisation and how our people, you know, nearly 5,000 of them across the country here in Wales, act and keep themselves and each other safe.
Can I just ask, obviously, as you say, it's a real different, stressed, sharp environment when you were at the front line, if you like, and you're obviously going into situations that you can't really risk assess because you don't know it. It's changing all the time. Genuine layman's question, does sort of health and safety go out the way? Are you just focused, your training kicks in, and then, or is it the back of your mind that you got your mate, you're going into a situation that potentially could be dangerous, or is it purely this is what I need to do?
No, it's actually, Mark, it's at the forefront of your mind. You know, we're always trained then and we do now to train our people to think about their safety first. You know, an injured first responder, an injured or, you know, worse, you know, dead emergency service worker is no good to anyone. So actually your safety and that of your crewmate or the people that you're with and those around you is uppermost in your mind. There's always a difficult balance in a dynamic risk assessment that you'll do as you approach a scene, as you approach an incident. But, you know, if it's not safe, you just don't do it. It's as simple as that, because, you know, you can't help others if you're injured or worse yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that. So you joined the Welsh, the Trust in September 2018. As you said, safety culture sort of goes up a bit more of a strategic level, maybe. Still the level of, you know, ultimately looking out for your colleagues and care. Do you recall what sort of safety culture you found there, and it, as you sort of bedded in there, and how important was it to, you know, was it on your to-do list? Was it top of the to-do list to sort of get a grip on?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly was. It was top of the to-do list, or one of the things at the top of the to-do list, amongst a number of others. I mean, what I guess I found, you know, it's fair to say, was a situation where we were primarily reactive. We weren't necessarily proactive in the prevention space. We were fairly traditional, I think it's fair to say, in our kind of operational response, and some of the systems that we needed weren't necessarily where we'd want them to be. It's fair to say, I think, you know, there was probably a legacy, perhaps is a good way to describe this, from Crown Immunity, which existed until 91. You know, I mean, that's a long time ago. Point. But, you know, it was a legacy, I think, where a safety culture was perhaps not as uppermost in people's minds as it needed to be, and certainly does need to be now, given that immunity doesn't exist. And therefore, it took time to break through that and kind of build or create the structures and the culture amongst all our people, not just in the leadership, in the management and leadership teams, but also in, you know, all of our frontline colleagues and those in other parts of the organisation too, create that culture where, you know, they have, every one of us has a responsibility for the safe working environment for, you know, ourselves and each other, and indeed our patients when we're out in communities serving them too.
I mean, it's a challenge, I think, for most. It's hear it a lot, sort of, it's the argument of what's gone before. This is how we've done it before. And it's always a challenge across many different verticals. And you raise a really good point about the Crown Immunity, and that didn't help, I guess. Like, that was another barrier, I guess, or sort of thing that you had to think about. But how did you sort of start to make those inroads? Was it just from the top down, you sort of given an example, saying, look, we're involved in this now, we're taking this seriously, and this is what we're going to do. It came from you, and you were keen to convey that, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, 91 was a long time ago.
It was a very long time ago,
but, you know, deeply embedded, I guess, you know, culture and beliefs that were around since then. Partly, you know, I guess my doing, but I'm not going to take all the credit for this, because it is a team effort, and, you know, others that are interested in the health, safety and well-being of our people, particularly trade union partners. You know, our trade union colleagues were uppermost in the conversations here about the change and the improvements that we needed to make and see. And of course, the other thing for me is, you know, at the time, the number one reason for people being absent from work was a result of soft tissue injuries, musculoskeletal injuries. Okay. Now, there's a whole load of stuff that, you know, you can do in our environment and that we have done, which reduce the likelihood or incidence or impact of, you know, soft tissue injuries. You know, ours is a physical job. Our people have to lift and carry people up and down stairs, often in those uncontrolled environments we spoke about before. Needing to remove patients, you know, sometimes from difficult, you know, confined spaces. You know, good lifting technique is sometimes a challenge in those environments. So soft tissue injuries are a big reason for absence. So, you know, I look at it from another perspective as a chief executive, saying, well, how can I keep my people fit and well at work? How can I reduce absence? How can I reduce cost as a result of that? Improve efficiency, but ultimately keep our people fit and happy at work. So there's all sorts of things that you'd kind of look at there. But I suppose they're the things which were uppermost in my mind when I came here, what, nearly 6 years ago.
Yeah, sure. That's a really good point, actually, Jason, about the musculoskeletal injuries that obviously it's lifted. When you strip it all back, it just comes down to simple, correct lifting, doesn't it? Which everyone knows about. And it's really interesting to identify. Now, listen, I just wanted to, whilst we have you here, talk about something that took place a while back, and that was when a non-emergency ambulance was transferring a patient to another hospital when it collided with a vehicle that was on the opposite side of the road. The patient, 76-year-old Janet Winspear, actually died in the crash after her stretcher harness wasn't secured properly. And after pleading guilty, the ambulance driver, Emrys Roberts, was jailed for 8 months. Now, I'm not going to go into much more of the case. It's been reported widely, and this isn't really the platform to do it on. But again, it raises, perhaps provides me the opportunity to ask you about that experience, because this is quite unique to get this perspective. And I wanted to ask you, as both, I guess, human and as a CEO, can you remember, you know, when you first sort of heard of the accident, what your initial thoughts were, and then your sort of immediate response?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, this is a really difficult and challenging sure. set of circumstances. And to the Winspear family, we've been in touch with the Winspear family clearly since this incident took place, this regrettable, sad incident took place. They have worked with us, to be fair, and been very dignified in how they've engaged with us, because we started from a position of throwing the doors open, Mark, recognizing that clearly there sure. was going to be stuff that we needed to learn and change as a result of this. And we've had quite a widespread program beyond what we needed to do in terms of supporting police investigations, the inquest, and the HSE's view. We started early with an approach that said, okay, what is there to learn, and let's look for those things and make those changes. It was not too dissimilar to an incident which occurred while I was overseas in Australia, but they are rare. These things are rare, thankfully rare, but there was no doubt in our minds that there was learning, both from a organizational perspective, but also in terms of the application of existing standard operating procedures and protocols by our people. And that was probably the biggest gap that we found. Whilst our education for new starters and our policies and procedures were pretty clear about, the use of restraints in the rear of the vehicle, so seat belts essentially on trolley beds, so restraining patients safely in the vehicle, it was pretty clear, the training is clear, the SOPs were clear. What we found is a culture which permitted those procedures not to be followed. And to be fair, if I think about my own personal experience back in the late, mid-late 90s, early 2000s on the road, it was prevalent then in another organisation. So yeah. This is something which has been around in the sector for a while and took, a bit of a Herculean effort on behalf of our entire team to move the dial to ensure that we have better compliance with that training and with those procedures in place.
Sure. Thanks, Jason. I appreciate you speaking about that. I when you touched on some of the changes you've made off the back of it, and as well, I guess there's that. It sounds like I'd assume it's a bit of a family community in sort of among you guys, and I wonder what the sort of effect emotionally that also has, because that's going to also almost sort of send a few sort of shockwaves to people. And was that something you had to consider as well, alongside the practical elements, the investigation, the HSE and compliance, et cetera? How was that sort of?
I mean, look, it's a really important point, because, I've gone straight to the kind of practical process points in my previous response. But as you rightly identify, there are kind of emotional impacts clearly for the two crew members, the two staff involved, the driver and the attendant, but also those in their station and the surrounding stations, and indeed across the entire organisation. Because as I say, death of a patient, a serious injury or death of a patient in our care is very, very rare. Clearly in our line of work, we're not able to save all of those patients that we go to in terms of a response to an 999 call. But this was a planned journey for a patient that was being conveyed from home to a healthcare facility. And so, harm or death in that circumstance is exceptionally rare. So yes, we did have to provide emotional support, not only to the two staff involved, but those who responded to the scene, and also, offer support to their colleagues around them. So the kind of impact is not just process driven on change that we need to deliver as a result of lessons identified, but also on supporting our people through what is a, you know, traumatic set of circumstances. And that doesn't just happen, you know, for a couple of days or a couple of weeks afterwards, because you've got the investigations, both our own and external agency investigations going on, an inquest and so on. So that support continues for months and years afterwards.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Thank you, Jason. As I say, I appreciate you answering, being so candid about that. I think from our point of view, this is ultimately, if you can look at it as a way of educating our readers also to sort of hear about your perspective. So thank you for speaking about that. I want to change tack slightly, if you like. And I mentioned at the beginning, you worked over, and you touched on it there, you worked over the other side of the world in Australia, where you were CEO of the South Australian Ambulance Services. I'm intrigued by this. First of all, how did that opportunity arise, because it's a whole new culture, a whole new place, and what were the sort of main challenges you sort of encountered from a safety point of view? And if I could just add another point to that, were there any differences or similarities, differences you've learned and taken into your new role?
So I've been working in London at that point for nearly 20 years. I left the London Ambulance Service in 2015. So been there for about 20 years. As you said, you know, started on the road as an emergency medical technician and finished as director of operations there. So from a career perspective, I was looking for my next challenge. I'd been involved in some international recruitment of people from Australia to London for a while. And as a result of that, kind of a network had established with the organisations there and the universities and so on. Anyway, an opportunity came up, which I applied for, and I was successful, and, you know, off we went to Australia. It was a fixed term 3-year contract, which I did for the 3 years, as you say, in South Australia. So based in Adelaide, but with a huge geographical patch. Different model in terms of workforce. So some, you know, half salaried, half volunteer. You know, the metropolitan areas were salaried staff. The rural and remote places were volunteers. And whilst we say in Wales we've got, you know, rural, remote and coastal areas, which we have, you know, it is nothing on the experience in Australia. I could easily drive for 2 days to visit some of my places, some of my stations. I mean, I'd fly, you know, you'd fly to visit some of your stations, because the geography is just huge. And those rural and remote stations, often volunteers, as I described, whilst their workload is much lower than what you'd see in the metropolitan areas, what they deal with is much more traumatic, you know. So it's heavy industry, it's heavy farming, you've got, you know, lots of mining incidents. You've got very high speed traffic incidents with big, you know, double Arctic lorries. You've got farm machinery incidents, so it's difficult stuff, and a consequence, and of course associated with that, you've got the safety issue. We've got remote crews isolated with limited support around them, limited if any management or leadership support when they're responding to an incident. So the kind of safety culture was actually much stronger, I found, there, because it had to be. In the environment, you know, the rural and remote environment that they were working in. You've also got the environmental factors, particularly, you know, as you went further up state towards the middle of Australia, towards the centre of Australia, where you've got, you know, very warm, hot, dry climate. So you've got those kind of environmental factors to consider with the safety of your people too.
Sure, brilliant. And how were you able to? I mean, we all learn from past experiences. Has that sort of galvanized what you've done going forward? There must be lessons that you can take with that, and also learnings as well.
Yeah, definitely. From a kind of a role perspective, you know, it's my first chief exec gig. You know, I did it for 3 years. You know, you know, there was definitely learning for me personally in kind of the approach to leading an organization that's, you know, dispersed. We got a dispersed workforce there. We got a dispersed workforce here. We're across 110, something like that, locations here, rural and remote, but not as extreme as it was there. Service delivery challenges are largely the same, but there was certainly learning for me personally from it. And I think from a perspective, particularly managing some of our volunteer workforce that we have here, there was definite learning from the experience in Australia, which we've been able to adopt here. And that's in terms of how we recognize our volunteers as professionals. So they're simply not volunteers. You know, that they are professional volunteers. Yeah. They're doing a professional job. They just happen not to be paid. So they, you know, they give up their time, one of their most valuable assets to us and their communities, freely. So lots of learning in that space. But a very good experience, very kind of fulfilling, if you like, and certainly helped me in the last, you know, 6 years here.
Yeah, sure. Brilliant. Thank you. Good stuff. We're sort of coming to the end now, Jason. Penultimate thing I wanted to ask, and again, really appreciate you coming on to the podcast. You touched on it as well about the safety of the personal safety of the ambulance workers. Unfortunately, there is risks around assault and being attacked, verbal and physical, I guess. And I know, speaking to some of your colleagues, there's actually, you're working on a campaign around that, sort of awareness campaign around that. If you don't mind, do you mind just sort of sharing a little bit more information about this?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, like, as you say, sadly, assaults, be they verbal or physical, are all too common on our people. Our contact center staff are subject clearly to verbal abuse rather than physical abuse from patients or callers, service users, pretty much on a daily basis. You know, some of the language and threats that they receive are just frankly abhorrent, and just completely outrageous. Similarly, our frontline staff, so those which are on the streets, you know, responding to patients, largely this is relevant to our 999 service, but it does happen sometimes in the non-emergency planned journey, kind of planned activity teams. But here, physical violence again is a feature, often fueled by drugs and alcohol, and sometimes, you know, our people are subject to, you know, pretty significant injuries, which mean they are either away from work for significant periods of time, or in some cases can't return. So when we look at the data across Wales, we see rising frequency, if you like. So together with emergency service partners, so the four police forces and the three fire services in Wales, we started to lead on a campaign a couple of years ago, which is kind of entitled With Us, Not Against Us, the idea being here, work with us, not against us. And we've had, you know, quite a bit of success with that. It's had some, you know, relatively high profile media coverage in Wales, and indeed has led to or supported an ambulance sector campaign across England too. We have seen, perhaps the most generous way to describe it, will be a stabilisation in the numbers, in the numbers of assaults. Which, when you think about activity going up, is a win. You know, so activity is going up year on year, and if we manage to stabilise the numbers, then that does feel like a win. But it's still too frequent and too prevalent. We use case studies of our people, so we're staff that have been subject to assault, you know, and they're willing to support the campaign. We work with them to tell their story, and the idea is that the campaign, you know, seeks to knock the conscience of those in the community which might think it's okay to abuse or assault our people. You know, and the data tells us it's particularly, you know, men, particularly those at or around 30 or under 30. You know, it's that kind of demographic where we've got the most prevalent. And what we're seeking to do is just remind people that it is just not okay. There is never, whilst situations where people call 999 are highly stressed, you know, often probably for them the first time they've ever been involved in that kind of scenario, we recognise all that. It's just never an excuse to assault our people. So where we've got particularly egregious, you know, assaults happening against our people, we will push for prosecution, and we've had some pretty good successes here in Wales with people being prosecuted and receiving custodial sentences for assaulting our people, because we're not going to sit idly by. Yeah, it's a small proportion of the community, but let them think it's okay.
No, absolutely, that's why I think it's really important, and we could probably have a whole new podcast on this as well, this discussion. But just crazy ultimately that you guys are trying to help people. But the campaign, I'll share some information to the campaign on our show notes, so we can sort of push it out to our readers at least. So thanks for sharing that, Jason. And do keep us updated as well. We'll keep in touch actually on how the campaign goes going forward. Right, we're unfortunately at the end. There's one question that I always ask my guests to round up, I think I could probably write what I think your response is going to be, but I'm really interested to hear what, you know, sort of motivates you, Jason. I think generally at the moment in 2024 in August, we recall just very end of July, beginning of August, what sort of motivates you to get out of bed in the morning and come to work?
Well, look, when I talk to all of the, so I try and see all the new entrants, all the new starters that join the organisation when they're in their basic training or in their induction program, and I and one of the lines I use is, you know, I joined on the 26th of February 96, you know what, nearly 28 years ago now. There is not one day in that 28 years where I've woken up and thought, you know what, I can't be bothered to go to work today. My main motivation, this sounds a bit perhaps naff, Mark, my main motivation, I joined, you know, at 21 in 1996 to help people. You know, I joined the NHS, the ambulance service, the NHS, to help people when they needed it most. And I came off the road. I chose to come off a frontline service delivery and go into management and leadership because I felt I could help more people more of the time by being in a management role. And that be that our own people, you know, so helping our own people or the patients that we're here to serve. So what motivates me? I'm driven by always looking to try and find the next thing to improve the workplace experience for our people or improve the care and the service we can provide to patients. So I'm strong on public service. I'm strong on supporting our people to do a great job and enabling them to be their best. We don't always get it right here. But we are very much open to learn. And, you know, I want to be part of an organisation which values its people, provides great care, and is seen and respected in our communities that we're here to serve. So that's what drives me.
Thank you. I don't think that's enough at all. I think it'll chime with our readers, ultimately people that work in health and safety. It's about helping people and it's about making people. So there's a really good sort of crossover there. So it's that's really, really good to hear. And again, thanks for being so candid with that. And then, we're unfortunately that's it. That's the end of the podcast. Again, Jason, really appreciate you coming on. It's been getting your insight into what goes into the roles such as yours, how from the top down strategically, but also it's obvious why you're doing this and that you want to help people. So again, thanks so much for coming on. Hopefully we'll keep in touch as well, because it's a really interesting viewpoint to get this vertical of the emergency services. So Jason Killins, Chief Executive at the Welsh Ambulance Service NHS Trust. Thanks so much for coming on. We appreciate it.
Great stuff. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, and that brings us to the end of this really unique podcast, which is great. I just want to say, give credit as well to Nicola White, who is head of health and safety at the Ambulance Trust. She sits on our editorial board at SHP and was able to instigate this, one of the first sort of conversations we've got, and just shows how embedded in and how joined up health and safety is at the organisation. So thanks to Nicola. Just to wrap up, just some final logistics bits. If you are new to the Safety Conversation podcast, please do go back and check out our previous episodes. If you do like what you hear, you can follow the podcast, I'm told, by marketing, say on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. You can also get it on your smart speaker, simply ask to play the Safety Conversation. We'd be very grateful if you could rate us and comment on your chosen platform, as this will help get our show out to a wider audience. Please do tune into shponline.co.uk for the latest health and safety news, and you can also sign up to our e-newsletter. Again, thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next episode. Take care.